Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics for Monday, January 30th, 2012. I'm Mitch Jezrich, and in fact, it's Saturday, January 28th, and it's about noon. And I'm coming to you from downtown Oakland, where right now many people are gathering as really a part of the first major action of the year by Occupy Oakland. People are gathering downtown at what they dubbed Oscar Grant Plaza. And in about an hour from now, they will march to an undisclosed location and take over a building. We don't know what building it is yet. That has not been made public. Occupy Oakland says that the building will either be owned by a public building, or it will be owned by a real estate company or a corporation that is vacant and not being used. Occupy Oakland says that they're going to take this building and they're going to make it really its headquarters. And in making it its headquarters, it's also going to try to provide services, probably services such as feeding people and services for the poor. Now, city administration officials and the police have indicated that unless the owner of the building is okay with Occupy Oakland being in it, that they will not permit it to happen, and that they should expect police to come in and evict people if necessary. Now, Occupy Oakland, in response, has sent a letter to the city saying that if that happens, if they are shut down, if they are evicted, if police raid the building, then Occupy Oakland will respond by either such action as shutting down the port for a number of days, if not try to do it permanently, or by even trying to shut down the Oakland airport, which is an international airport. The effects of it would be incredible. So that's the situation now. Again, about an hour from now, people will begin to march out, and as they do, we're going to follow them.
Command all those assembled at 12th Street to immediately leave the area. If you do not do so, you may be arrested or subject to removal by force if necessary, which may result in serious...
Well, actually, I've just been informed that the building that they wanted to try to take over, Occupy Oakland, was the Kaiser Auditorium building. And in fact, that's what we're just outside right now. Not sure if the Kaiser Auditorium has been in service for some time. It's a big old building. It's a historic building. Riot police are surrounded around it right now, and it looks like this is the place that Occupy Oakland intended to occupy, the Kaiser Auditorium building. Well, this is once again turned into another altercation with the police. The city warned that police would keep Occupy Oakland from taking over a building unless the owners of that building approved of it. We have since left the Kaiser Auditorium. Some more smoke bombs or tear gas. I'd have to say a lot of people are not running away at this point. What's happening? What are you seeing?
They are launching flashbangs and tear gas at the crowd in front of the Oakland Museum. They have done that. They did that earlier in front of the empty building that we were trying to occupy, which is...
Well, police are now charging and everyone running. Charging from multiple ways now. I'm looking at it. The police are moving in on protesters, arresting people.
I still think it's worth it.
Take the plaza! Take the plaza!
We're not done
Now here with Leo Ritz Barr. Leo Ritz Barr is somebody who's been very active in Occupy Oakland. Saw a photo of you at the press conference about this event today. We're now back at the plaza at City Hall. First off, what happened?
The march began, and while being slightly sporadic, it snaked its way all the way through Laney College and then back around. We almost went back down and around towards the heading towards the building. When we had arrived, obviously there were lines of riot police running up and down the hill. People were assembled in front, and the police released some smoke bombs. People thought that it was tear gas. There's been various reports of tear gas, smoke bombs. People started marching away from there and just back to the plaza. And on the way, numerous times were repeatedly attacked unprovoked, after being not provoking the police, obviously, but they were repeatedly beaten down. Journalists were beaten while filming. They were shot with rubber bullets, and flashbang grenades were set off.
What do you think it means to have not been able to take over the Kaiser Auditorium? Do you see it as a disappointment for Occupy Oakland? Was it a defeat? Was it a failure? What?
No. I mean, you know, some people will say, oh, this is like the end of the defining moment of the end, you know, like they failed. I mean, I'd say this hasn't been the first time Occupy Oakland has made a mistake, nor would I say that this will be the last time. And we pulled off crazy, Occupy Oakland has pulled off some pretty crazy things in the past. Things that, you know, before people would never thought would be possible, but now suddenly anything seems on the table.
I read in the press that Occupy Oakland sent a letter to the city saying that if the police kept an occupation of a building from happening, that there will be a response to that, potentially even trying to shut down the Oakland airport.
Yeah, those were, I read some of that letter off at the press conference, and, you know, it was the Occupy Oakland Move-In Assembly. It wasn't ratified by the General Assembly, right? But I think it's up to the people of Oakland right now to decide what the response is.
Finally, Leo, what was the importance of trying to have a building, of potentially occupying the Kaiser Auditorium?
Well, any building, I didn't know the Kaiser was the building. Any building as a social center for the people of Oakland would have provided much of the same services that were offered here at the camp at Oscar Grant Plaza. A lot of people feel like that's something that's needed and necessary in order for the continuing growth of the movement, to have a space to call our own, be able to organize politically, and also take care of each other personally. So it's a very personal, the personal is political in that, you know, this is, Occupy Oakland needed a home. And our home for a little while, like since November 14th, essentially, since the second raid, has been in direct action, being together. We are at home when we are taking the streets together. And having a building where we can continue some of the same processes that occurred here at the camp would be great. But again, when we occupy space, what we've proven is, though we may leave after being in one for a good amount of time, doesn't mean that we won't be back. And ultimately, while physical space is important, I find that the energy and political space created by folks gathering together, be it at a plaza or in the streets, is something that is beautiful to behold.
Your name?
Yeah, my name is Daniel Borgstrom, and I was with the demonstration all day today, starting from the plaza and then marching up and down zigzag streets. And finally, at a certain point, you know, we started seeing police close in around us. And then at one point I saw them way up ahead smoke, and then I didn't know what that was. But then later on we got onto, I forget which street it was, but it was one of those streets there. And people around were moving up there. They had a aluminum door, using it as a shield, and carrying banners, you know, carrying them, moving right up to the police. And they were throwing back various types of grenades. At first I think there were smoke grenades. And then I think also tear gas grenades, because I started kind of choking. And at one point, someone was pointing a gun of some sort, a shoulder weapon at me, right by
face. Police officer?
A police officer was pointing a shoulder weapon. I don't know if it was a pellet gun or what. Immediately, I pulled this up to my face, put my arm over my face. There was no, he did not shoot. But I was afraid of it. I mean, God, here's where I go blind.
Right.
That was my third. And these
people. Daniel, forgive my frankness, but how old are you?
I'm 70. One thing, can I just say, what really, why this really touches me closely is at a personal level. As at the age of 70, I get 950 a month. That's what I live on. 958,
Social Security,
Social Security. There's some SSI and there's something from the state. And, of course, I depend on, I'm counting on Medi-Cal, things like that. Well, right now, I'm getting by. I am getting by okay. And, you know, I have to, like these pants I have on, I got them in a free box. This I inherited, the shirt I inherited from somebody. I get by. And I'm, that's okay. But they are talking about cutting it, and it's on one hand, it's the Republicans who are talking about cutting this, and then the Democrats go right along with them. So I don't trust the Democrats any better than I trust the Republicans.
Now, joining me here in downtown Oakland is Moran. Some of our listeners may remember Moran when we did a live broadcast at Occupy San Francisco. Moran was somebody who is battling cancer. She was getting treatment over at Occupy San Francisco and also, I believe, by San Francisco General Hospital.
It wasn't official cancer treatment. It was just for as it happened, whatever I needed, I got. That has since stopped because Occupy San Francisco is kind of gone right now. We sub GA and whatnot.
What kind of cancer are you battling?
I'm battling CML leukemia, chronic myelogenous. Myelogenous is, it associates with the cells in your spine and your bone marrow. So it's pretty much, it's pretty much everywhere, but it's centralized more towards my kidneys and my chest area. It's really starting to suck. The pain that I was in when you interviewed me last has tripled, and I'm still learning to get along with that.
Tell me a little bit more about what happened to you today.
Well, cops chased us around. I stayed towards the back of the march or towards the front of the cops, watching for tear gas grenades. And when one went off, I started getting people who got tear gassed out of there. Obviously, as a result of that, I got tear gassed myself. I took care of it myself as well and just went about my day. For me, it's not a big deal.
Some people might say with as you're trying to battle this cancer that doing all this activism may not be something that is good for your health.
It definitely is. There's taxes to be paid for it. There's definitely taxes to be paid for it. Ow. Sorry, I'm more focused on the fact that my lungs are still burning.
From the tear gas?
Yeah. I'll be all right, though.
Take your time.
My body does react a lot worse to a lot of the stuff that I go through as an activist that a lot of other activists go through. It's a lot harder on me. And yeah, I guess from a housing perspective, if I were smart, I wouldn't be so active, but I'm out here because this is what I've got left. Occupy's all I've got. And it's given me a sense of hope that maybe I'm not leaving behind a world that's completely lost. You know, I've come to terms with the fact that I'm going to die. I've come to complete terms with that. I'm okay. But what I really hated for a long time was the thought that I'm leaving behind a world that was as broken and just destroyed as this is. And Occupy has given me a hope that when I leave, things are still going to get better. The little sister I'm leaving behind has a chance. And her chance rests in Occupy, and if we don't succeed, a lot of kids are going to get hurt from it.
How old's your little sister?
She's 12.
How old are you?
19. I was 18 last time you interviewed me.
Well, happy birthday, since I haven't seen you since.
It was December 30th.
Oh, all right. Well, it's still recent.
Yeah, it's great to see you. I've got to get back to work.
It's good to see you, and I thank you, Moran. Well, now, it's been a few hours since I talked to you last. It's probably close to 7 o'clock at night. Well, this is interesting. We're now at the city hall, and the doors are open, and there is no one here. And people are now going into it. People right now are occupying City Hall. The door was open. I just came up here a moment ago. It was propped open. And now there are people inside. This is interesting. Actually outside whether or not to go in, but people are going in, and the police helicopter is here now, and they just put down the spotlight, so it is clear that the police now know.
Cover your faces.
I mean, if we go in, they can definitely just block the big kid, and then we'll all be arrested. That's what's gonna happen. It's unlocked.
We want to silently.
It's unlocked. Get in. Go in.
City Hall is open and people are going into it. You can see that a lot of people here are hesitant to go in.
Don't break it. Don't break it.
Very well could be more people outside than inside.
Please don't take pictures.
Again, we're just outside City Hall. I'm here with Monique. Monique, we just saw people. Oh, they just brought the American flag out of the, from City Hall. Again, City Hall in Oakland has been occupied. Yes. You've seen what I've seen.
This is awesome. I mean, they got the flag in front of the building. We did not open, I repeat, the doors. They were already open. We're not trashing it, but we're letting you know we've been here and we're going to stay here. We're here to stay. Occupy Oakland, baby. Hey, brother.
It's a bit shocking that it was open, though, when we got here.
It was shocking. It's like God himself said, I'm giving you the building to occupy until they get here. And Jesus said, occupy everything till he returns. Amen. They're burning the freaking flag. Oh, my God.
This is a scene. They just brought out the American flag. They just brought out the American flag from City Hall. And now they are, and it's on a stand. Burning it.
You don't care about America?
They're now burning the American flag that they just brought out of City Hall.
God bless the world.
This is crazy.
Don't fight over the stupid flag.
You heard a big bang.
What was that?
Long
as
we
don't
get tear gas,
I got a mask. I gotta get my.
Again, this is a. There, all right. Again, this is a wild scene. You can just feel the tension of what's going to happen. Still. Again, people are inside City Hall. There are probably even more people outside. I think people are hesitant to run inside. I think a lot of people are surprised that City Hall was even open to begin with.
It wasn't earlier, man. They must take off the hinges or something. I seen people trying to open it earlier just a few hours ago, and it wasn't opening at all.
I came here right before this happened, and I looked, and I didn't really pay attention, but I did notice that a door was propped open.
Really?
It was propped open, something holding it open. And then I saw a couple of folks run over and in, and here we are.
Well,
again, they are burning the American flag that they took out of the city hall. They said they're also in the city chamber now. The police have now shown up. They have fired tear gas into the plaza. Many people are now running away, including myself. And again, those were some of the sounds from Saturday in Oakland, mostly throughout downtown Oakland. And you are listening to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Now, Occupy Oakland did reconvene downtown on Sunday. It held a general assembly and also hosted a talk between two leading anarchist scholars, David Graeber, one of the original Occupy Wall Street activists, and Andre Grubacek. David Graeber is also author of the book Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and Andre Grubacek is the author of such books as Wobblies and Zapatistas. We now turn to extended excerpts of their discussion. This is Andre Grubacek.
So let me start from a global, more global perspective and say that in my opinion, there were certain moments in the history of global radical movements. The first moment was between 1860 and 1917. But people, usually historians and other people who should know, refer to this as the first moment of globalization. In this period, there was a tremendous collaboration between anarchist movements, anarchists, and anti-colonial movements. It was so fascinating that some people like Benedict Anderson, for example, himself a Marxist, or even worse, a person by the name of Eric Hobsbawm, a Marxist, Stalinist historian, actually had to admit that Marxism in this century was pretty irrelevant to what was happening globally. There was a huge shift around 1917 with the October putsch of the Bolshevik-Leninists, and this was the beginning of what might be termed Marxist-Leninist century or Marxist-Leninist moment, the second moment in the history of global radical culture. Finally, 1968, at least to my mind, represent a rupture, a break, a beginning of something new, a beginning of undefined new moment that is challenging the assumptions of the Marxist-Leninist century, which were basically based on the premise that the only way to change the society, to change the world, is to take over the power of the state. When you take the power of the state, then you go on and you reinvent the society. I was born in a socialist country, state socialist country of Yugoslavia, and that's what we were taught. We have to invent the new socialist man, they will tell us, a new socialist woman, new socialist humanity. But first, we need to take the power of the state, and then we are going to do all of these wonderful things. So I think that we are in a new moment right now. We are still trying to define globally what's the objective of our new revolutionary politics is. I believe that 20th century have proved with immense cruelty that the idea of taking the power of the state and then trying or attempting to change the world is profoundly problematic. It's not enough. We need to think differently. We need a new revolutionary imagination, which is freed from the ideas of the state, freed of the ideas of taking over the power of the state, and free of the old, very apocalyptic ideas of what revolution as an event should be like. Revolution is not an event, it's a process. So I would like to ask David, who is our guest, coming from, Occupy Wall Street, among many other places. He is responsible for 99%, among other things. To tell us, this is his slogan, he came up with it. To tell us more about how he sees occupations, Occupy movement, and how he sees this in relation to this new moment of global radicalism that, in my opinion at least, we've been living since 1968.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Thanks. Let me think what to do with that. Yeah, the irony of what you're talking about, the way that, you know, between 1860s and 1917, it really was like anarchism was the center of the global revolutionary left. Marxists rapidly became social democrats. It's funny because there was this total role reversal that happened in 1917. Because before that, it was the Marxists saying, well, we have no conception of what a true democratic society would be like. We're not even going to try. It's going to be a total rupture. We can't imagine it. The anarchists were saying, no, we have to build the new society in the shell of the old. And then suddenly, you know, the Marxists got Russian Revolution, and they were like, oh, what are we going to do? Because the world revolution didn't happen. So they kind of switched roles. They said, okay, we will build a new society in the shell of the world order, except just through a government. And I always wondered how that happened. And why it is that suddenly anarchism sort of faded out for about 80 years, and why it suddenly reappeared again. The moment, 89, 91, where the Soviet Union fell apart. And I think the real answer is war. That, you know, the period between 1914 and 1991, all people were doing was either fighting world wars or preparing for world wars. That was the only game in town. And anarchists, I mean, you know, we're good at a lot of things, but the one thing we're never going to be very good at is, like, building giant tank armies, you know, creating nuclear weapon systems. I personally feel that's to our credit. But, you know, Marxists actually proved to be pretty good at that. So suddenly, you know, being a Marxist seemed realistic and being an anarchist seemed irrelevant. You know, the moment that it no longer seemed like we were going to have giant world wars anymore in the same way, Marxists kind of disappeared and the anarchists suddenly are back again. So, center of global revolutionary movements is what we're seeing now. I mean, the first reaction of the people running the show was to try to start another global world war, the war on terror. But it kind of didn't work. They immediately pulled out the biggest weapon at their disposal in like 2000 after Seattle, after the big summit mobilizations, which is to start a major war mobilization. And that's I think we're really at a really interesting historical moment because I don't think they can do that anymore. If you look at American history for the last 30, 40 years, every time there's a mass grassroots democratic movement based on principles, direct democracy, direct action, civil disobedience, the same thing happens. The people running the country become completely terrified. It happened during the civil rights movement. It happened during the anti-nuclear movement in the 70s. Happened after the globalization movement in 99-2000. It's always the same thing. They freak out. They panic. They make mass concessions, and then they start a war. So, like, right after the civil rights movement, you have Vietnam. Right after the anti-nuclear movement, you know, they conceded on the nukes, and then they, you know, basically ended detente and started wars in Afghanistan, Nicaragua, El Salvador. Right after globalization movement came the global war on terror. I don't see how they can do that this time. I mean, they're not actually going to declare war on Iran. I don't think they have the resources, the ability to do it. There's nobody else that they could actually have a war with about blowing up the world. So they're kind of stuck. So we kind of got them over a barrel this time. They didn't expect it to happen so fast, and I'm not sure what they can do about it. When we were actually first talking about all this back in Tompkins Square Park, when we were planning the Zuccotti Park, we didn't know it was going to be Zuccotti Park yet, the occupation, we had a lot of arguments about this, and we made a series of really clear decisions, which I think are one of the reasons why this thing took off. And one of the big debates was about police liaisons, certain Trotskyist factions that I won't mention, you know, were very keen on having them, and we decided overwhelmingly no. So when it comes to conflict, I mean, you know, if everybody could get along, we wouldn't be here. I mean, we're doing this because there is no basis to get along with people who are destroying people's lives. You know, maybe it will benefit them in the long, greatest scheme of things to be liberated from their own oppression. I'd like to do them that favor, but they're not going to let us do it voluntarily. we made a very clear decision. Because we made a decision that essentially that this was going to be a form of dual power. That we are not going to apply for permission to do anything. That we are not going to negotiate with them about anything. And that we're not going to make demands of them to do anything. I mean, it's up to them to prove to us why they should even exist. We don't have to prove anything. We're the people of this country. Yeah. And I think that we need to remind people of that over and over again. I mean, we're asked to justify ourselves. We have no reason to justify anything. People in this country don't have to justify anything. They have to justify to us why they have any legitimacy whatsoever. And I think what's happening in this country is that people are recognizing this. What we have here is not a system of democracy. We have a system of institutionalized bribery. It's a system of institutionalized bribery where basically they loot our money. And I think to some point, at this point, it's like 20% of the average American's income is directly appropriated by the financial services industry. They just take the money, they give it to politicians, and politicians write laws so they can take more. It's not even capitalism anymore. It's some kind of weird system of feudalism, something like halfway between feudalism and just sheer extortion. And the idea that we're supposed to go to the guys who are operating this system saying, well, we have some ideas of how you might, you know, sort of reform things a little bit here. No, it's ridiculous. We need to delegitimize the entire system. I mean, you know, if we're going to get anywhere, we have to make this like Argentina in 2001. We got to get it to the point where politicians can't go to a restaurant. They have to wear disguises, you know. People will start throwing food at them. They can't buy cigarettes without people throwing vegetables. And it can happen, man. I mean, you know, it's already happened in a lot of places. People in this country hate politicians. They know these guys are on the take. I don't think we have very far to go. And that's the way we're going to see change, because it'll force them to the position where they have to prove to us why they are in any way relevant to our lives.
Another thing, we never had democracy, or you guys never had democracy here in the United States. One of the things that people usually mention about the United States is that this was somehow a democratic society and we need to take this country back. There's nothing worse than the idea of taking the country back. I don't even know what it means. However, without going through the finesse of taking the country back, and my allergies to the thing, to the disease called patriotism aside, I don't think that this country was ever democratic. And if you read Federalist Papers, if you read any of the documents back in the days when this aristocratic capitalist republic was created, well, you will read not only that there were slave owners, you will read that they actually hated democracy. The idea of the so-called founding fathers was to create a society that will resemble Imperial Rome. That's where the Senate is coming from. The idea was not to have a democratic society, because democratic society was identified with Athens, ancient Athens, which all of them thought was the worst example that had ever created, and they wanted to prevent what they called the mob, or they also use the term of great unwashed. There were many other colorful terms that they used. They wanted to prevent these people from actually taking power, or having actually any power. So the idea that the United States was a democracy and that we need to take it back is just preposterous. Late Murray Bookchin used to say, democratize democracy, radicalize democracy, democratize the republic. We need to begin with the idea that this is a capitalist republic. There's nothing democratic about this except for us. The only democratic element today in the United States is the Occupy movement and people who are actually willing to go and build the differences. And we anarchists used to say, building the facts of the future in the present. And this is what I think that we are doing with the Occupy movement. Well, sure, many people are critical, and David can tell us more about his response to this criticism, that we are not doing this well enough, that we are not good in terms of strategy, that there is a lot of what Marxists used to call of interclass conflict, lots of different conceptions, a lot of problems of representation, inclusion. And all of this is true, but we are working it out. We are trying to create something else, facts of future in the present. And I think if we're going to think about democracy, real democracy, it doesn't exist in the United States, except for in the history books. The only democracy that have ever existed was a democracy that was always continually suppressed.
Yeah, actually, I always like to annoy people by pointing out to them that nowhere in the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence does it say anything about America being a democracy. Those guys hated democracy. They were totally against it. And actually, it's, you know, if you look at why they didn't like it, I just got this great quote from John Adams about that just the other day. He said, well, we can't have a democracy in this country if we had a majority vote. When we got 2 million people with property and 9 million people without, you know what's going to happen if we have a majority vote. The first thing they're going to do, they're going to abolish the debts. Second thing they're going to do, they're going to try to equalize property. This would be disaster. Well, you know, I think we could use some democracy now. Yeah, what those guys discovered, they said, well, yeah, we're going to form a republic. We're going to make sure there's no democracy, you know, to suppress the dangers of democracy. He called it the horrors of democracy, is that they used to call it. But then they discovered as soon as they started running for office, everybody liked the idea of democracy. So they just took the system that was set up to suppress democracy, this Republican system, and just relabeled it and said, no, this is democracy. And that's what we got now. It's happened in the 1830s. Andrew Jackson was the first one who did it. The same thing happened in France. The same thing happened in England. They set up all these elaborate systems to suppress democracy, and then they discovered that, like, actually everybody liked the idea. They had to win elections, so they just relabeled the anti-democratic system democracy. I mean, all those right-wing people, when they say, oh, this isn't a democracy, it's a republic, they're actually right. But we want to make it a democracy. Which means addressing exactly the kind of issues that those guys were afraid we were going to address. I mean, I think, like, we have a country of debt peons. We have a country of people who, if anybody for most periods of history saw us, they would think as a population of slaves, people renting themselves out because they're so deep in debt they have no choice. So we got to start thinking about what it would take to create a society where you could have a real democracy, where people can sit together and solve actual problems that we have in an egalitarian fashion. And the first thing that we're going to have to do is get rid of capitalism. I think what we have seen for the last 30 years is a desperate war on the human imagination. And the reason this is happening, and this is what we always have to remember, because we go around half the time feeling kind of pathetic, like in ineffective, but the fact is, they're scared of us. They're actually terrified of us. They're so terrified of us that they're designing their entire ruling strategy around making sure things like this don't get off the ground. So they must be quaking in their boots right now. For 30 years, they've been like, everything has been about making sure this doesn't happen. Ever since the 60s. I mean, they've designed their wars around making sure there's no anti-war movement. They're more obsessed with making sure there's no effective anti-war movement. They don't even care if they're going to win the war. I mean, they're willing to set up rules of engagement, make sure they lose the war so they don't have enough bodies that they don't, so there's no mass resistance. They'll shut down IMF summits just so we can't do it because they're so obsessed by us not winning, they don't even care if there is an IMF summit. They're completely obsessed by making sure that mass social movements don't take off. And there's been the key to this has been a war on the human imagination. I mean, probably 20% of the resources of capitalism have been pumped into propaganda, have been pumped into security, have been pumped into psychological warfare against anything that even looks like it might be an alternative, anything that even looks like it might be a movement that could challenge capitalism. And the result is that everybody's left here thinking, well, capitalism is the only thing that could possibly exist. At this very moment that the whole thing's completely falling apart because, you know, they're pumping all their resources into, like, making it look like it's inevitable has destroyed the system. You know, they've been more interested in winning the propaganda war than creating a system that actually works. So all things crumbling around them, and most people are just sitting around, like, not knowing what to do because the only system that could possibly exist is falling apart right in front of their eyes. Our job is to show them exactly what they're afraid of. Is to show them that alternatives work and that we're here to replace them. I think we have to start by realizing that they've put us in a conceptual trap. I mean, that's what the War on Imagination does. It says there's only two possibilities. There's a state and the market. Somehow they're opposed. Actually, if you look at history, if you don't have states, you don't have markets. States created markets, and markets are necessary to sustain states. They go with each other, and one's never going to get rid of the other. They never got rid of wage labor in any of the socialist states, and that's the thing that really oppresses people about markets most of all. We need to throw away the whole baggage, and the way to start doing that is to look around us and start realizing that, like, the things we're already doing that they don't want us to think about. I mean, most of us are already living in communism when we're dealing with our best friends, when we're dealing with our families. Most of us are already dealing with anarchists. I mean, anytime you go up to someone and you work something out together in a reasonable fashion that doesn't involve bringing in the police and that you don't need, like, cops to enforce, you're being an anarchist. Most people are already anarchists most of the time. Friendship is inherently communistic and anarchistic. Love is inherently communistic and anarchistic. We're already doing that. So it's not a matter of creating some total new system. It's a matter of taking what we're already doing and just kind of expanding it a little.
And I know that many of you have a penchant for French philosophy and you like to read those books. I actually read yesterday, and I wrote it down, something by a American volunteer from the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. And I have to say, David's father was one of those heroic Americans who went to Spain and fight the fascists. And one of them, who is probably a comrade of your dad, said, something. He said, the stuff we are made of never goes away because the bastards will never cease their evil and the decent human beings will never stop their struggle. And this is so charmingly simple. You know, it's no French accents, no, you know, big words. But basically it sums it up in a way that I can understand. And that means that there are certain people who we might call bastards. I will call them the ruling class, who will never cease their evil because why would they? It works really well for them. And decent human beings, that is us, will never stop their struggle. And it's true. And this is exactly the stuff that we are made of never goes away. The thing is, just not to think about this, again, coming back to Žižek and his address, when he was speaking in Zuccotti Park, I don't know, David, if you were there, he said that it's probably for the better, but he did say something that we should not fall in love with ourselves. And, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with falling in love with ourselves from time to time. I actually think it's a good thing. But I think what he was trying to say is that we need to get serious about what we really want. And we should stop insisting on many different ways of getting along with the people who are the evil bastards who will not cease their evil. And we need to figure out ways of creating a system, of creating possibilities of a serious confrontation with the people who right now are in power. And we are actually well equipped to do so. We just need to be strategically intelligent. We need to figure out ways of doing this. We need to find appropriate tactics, and we need to figure out ways of doing this. But this is not a walk in the park. This is not a ballet dance. This is not an opera. This is a struggle. This is a fight. This is a battle. This is class war. This is a war, and we are in it for the long haul. Please don't forget that. This is not something where we can talk to them, and then we can talk to somebody else, and then we can petition somebody over there. No. This is a war, and we need to be serious about this, and we need to be dedicated about this, and we need to know that this war will go on, and it will last until one class prevails.
And that was Andrei Grubachik. He is a professor of anthropology, also an anarchist scholar, author of such books as Wobblies and Zapatistas. He was in discussion with another anarchist scholar, David Graeber, author of the book Debt, the First 5,000 Years. He's also an original Occupy Wall Street member. And they were in conversation yesterday at Occupy Oakland just before the General Assembly.